Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinsel. Has the Green Mountain Care Board been successful in controlling the cost of health care in Vermont? Some people think the answer seems to be yes and no. While Vermont's hospitals are seeking a roughly 3.5% increase in their budgets next year, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, the state's largest insurer, is asking for a 7.2% increase in premiums. Al Gobe is the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board. He says efforts to control health care costs can never be successful unless Vermont moves away from the current fee-for-service model and adopts a very different approach to how health care providers are paid.
If we continue to chase volume in health care with the demographics of our state, you know, becoming more aged, we will never, never get to a trend that we can live with. That is something that we must be committed to, we will have little to say about how much health care costs over the next 10 years.
How does the current system need to be changed, and will it have an impact on the quality of care that Vermonters receive? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobe. Al, great to have you back on the program.
Thank you. Great to be back.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Do you think the state is making progress in slowing down the growth rate of healthcare costs? Do you have some ideas on how to do that? Do you think healthcare providers should be reimbursed for keeping their patients healthy? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, or you can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net, or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So let's start with the hospital budgets. Last year, the overall growth rate for hospital budgets in Vermont was 2.7%. This year, they're proposing a 3.6% increase, but that still needs to be reviewed by the Green Mountain Care Board, so it's likely it might come down a little bit. So this is now 3 years in a row that hospital budgets have been relatively low, down close to the rate of inflation. Can we say that this is a trend that's developing in Vermont, and is it an important trend?
It is absolutely a trend that's developing in Vermont, and it's a very important trend. And let me explain why. The word sustainable is probably overused in so many different parts of our economy and our conversations. But in healthcare, I want to define it for the folks that are listening. Sustainable to me means that healthcare costs grow more in alignment with the growth of our economy. And we have worked with the hospitals to get their net patient revenue growth to the point where it's actually, you know, almost at the 3.5 mark, which is we've grown as a state 3.5% for the last 15 years on average. So we've seen a good result there, but I want to say that that's just through regulation and cooperation. The hospitals have done a great job. But that doesn't mean that we're satisfied or that we've accomplished all the goals that we have, because regulation is not innovation. And innovation is where we need to get away from the fee-for-service, from the quote that you just had from me earlier, and move to a system that actually has better access for folks and actually improves quality and focuses more on prevention. And so those are all things I've talked about before. But the first thing we had to do was regulate the system so that we could begin to afford it. But to the folks out there that are seeing some of these insurance rate increases and that are struggling to afford their deductibles, you know, this isn't, you know, necessarily something that they feel. And I do recognize that.
So what have the hospitals done to help control their costs? What are they doing differently now than they did maybe 5 or 10 years ago?
You know, so, you know, I think the critical thing is that when you're planning a budget, whether you're a restaurant like my business or a hospital, you plan, you know, different things that you want to do in any given year, what your capital expenditures are, what you're doing, you know, with your staff. And moderating all of those things is a big part of moderating healthcare costs. But also, if you talk to the hospital leadership, you'll find all sorts of innovations that they've done to try to bring costs out of the system. Because we talk about revenue, but really it's the cost of healthcare that we're trying to get under control. And so they've worked tirelessly to do that.
Now, the board does allow the hospitals to add a little bit to their budgets for innovation purposes. I think this year it's 0.6% they can add to their budget. What kind of things does that fund? What do you want to see them do with that money?
You know, we pretty much open it up to them to come to us with ideas. We have, you know, sort of a list of criteria, but it's just a guide. It's not, you know, it's not overly prescriptive. But if you take a look at Northwestern Hospital decided that they wanted to lower their emergency room admissions because obviously, I think most people know, going to the emergency room is one of the most expensive ways to access care. And so they've worked on building urgent care. They've worked on building primary care to try to make access greater so that people don't have to go to the emergency room. They have seen a tremendous result from that, and that drives costs out of the system. And it's, you know, it's fascinating what they've been able to do.
You know, now we're seeing hospitals and even doctors who work for hospitals do advertising, television ads, radio ads, print ads. I mean, this is sort of a new development. Do you think that's a good practice because it helps promote competition, or do you have some problems with this approach?
So it's interesting. I think the most the highest volume of ads that I see are from New Hampshire. You know, so Littleton Regional has done a ton of advertising in the Chittenden County area, maybe other parts of the state. You know, so, you know, that's an interesting development. You know, what I would say is that when advertising is educational, when advertising is instructive, it's a benefit. The state, you know, there's a thing that the Constitution keeps us out of this game. But, you know, I think that in a nonprofit environment, hospitals should be very, very careful as to how much money they spend on advertising. But that's just me using the bully pulpit. I don't think the state or the federal government really should weigh in on that.
Do those advertising dollars ultimately get paid for by ratepayers?
Yes. I mean, the key thing to remember is that everything gets paid for by ratepayers, pretty much. I mean, there's a little bit of grant money and things like that that taxpayers pay, which is the other source of revenue. But I think of it as the patients in some way pay for everything.
Today on the program, our guest is the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobay. We're discussing efforts to control health care costs in Vermont. What are your thoughts? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking about this cost shift. That's when the government chronically underfunds its health care programs like Medicaid and Medicare. Should the legislature do something about the cost shift? 1-800-639-2211. So you've been talking about the hospital budgets at 3.6%, and you talked about Blue Cross Blue Shield at 7.2%, a revised rate increase for them. Some people may be scratching their heads and saying, no, wait a minute, the hospitals are at 3.6. Blue Cross is double that. Last year, Blue Cross came in pretty close at the end at a little less than 8%. I think their proposal was closer to 10, but you knocked it down to just below 8. So some people are thinking, what gives here?
And the answer was in the question. So what gives here is that we basically say hospitals, you can grow at 3%. They willingly and cooperatively have embraced that. But unfortunately, Medicaid doesn't agree with that and go up at 3%. And Medicare doesn't go up at 3%. And so for the entire book of business, most of that increase is borne by the commercial payer. And so a 3 can become a 6, a 7, or an 8, depending on the hospital's unique mix of Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial. And each hospital around the state has a very different mix depending on their community. And so therefore, the cost shift affects each hospital differently. But in the aggregate, it has the effect that you're talking about.
So would you say that the cost shift is the primary reason why Blue Cross is asking for a rate increase that is double that of the hospital budgets?
I would say that their medical trend is greatly impacted by that. There are drivers in these rate cases that are not about medical or pharmaceutical trend, which have to do with changes in federal law that do impact these rates. So, you know, that's a little tougher to explain and understand, but it's a driver.
I mean, when we look at the cost shift statistics and the projections for 2015 for the hospitals, Medicare, $175 million. Medicaid, $150 million. Free care, $26 million. Bad debt, $41 million. This is a total of almost $400 million in a cost shift that somebody has to pay, and that somebody turns out to be the private health insurer model. Governor Peter Shumlin proposed doing something about this last year. Lawmakers didn't like the idea of a payroll tax. Is this an issue that you'd like to see lawmakers tackle?
Well, it's interesting. This is about being able to explain the world's craziest pinball machine to the business community and to the individuals that purchase health insurance and say to them, you know, you're being chronically overcharged. And we don't think that's right, and we think that, you know, we should probably equalize this, because you don't want Medicaid patients unable to access care because, you know, providers just literally cannot afford to you know, take care of those people. You don't want it to go that far. So, you know, how do you explain that to a business owner? Hey, we're going to raise your taxes over here, but we're going to lower your premium over here, when you never know where the pinball is going to go in this machine. And so it's a tough sell to the business community. And it was last year. And obviously it didn't survive. And so my point to the legislature has been and will be, we're probably not going to solve this whole problem, but let's not let it get any worse. Let's put money into Medicaid to at least allow it to keep up with inflation and the rates that we're approving. And so I'll always be an advocate for that.
Because right now, under the Affordable Care Act, we see more people in Vermont through expanded Medicaid. And so doesn't that just make this problem even worse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the conversation around Medicaid, you know, the governor rightfully brought it up last session. But I think that it's going to be one of the main topics of interest in the governor's election that's coming up, because how you deal with Medicaid will determine your ability to govern. So this is not a small question for our state. This may be one of the top three questions for our state.
How do you see that becoming an issue? What are the dynamics of that discussion?
Well, if Medicaid is the budget, you know, as Medicaid grows, it becomes more and more of the state budget. If it is the budget, you know, legislators are human. They don't want to raise taxes. So how do you fund it? You know, so the answer is, well, don't fund it. Well, then the cost shift gets worse. Then access gets worse. This is going to be a big issue that is going to have to be really, really examined over the next couple of years, because it's not just an issue of the cost shift. It's an issue of the entire state budget.
Let's go to our callers and start with Claire, who's calling from Norwich. Hi, Claire. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just have a couple of comments. Actually, I have four total, and I'll be quick. First of all, I think that the client, the customer, the patient in the system that we have now has virtually no say. And I think that's one of the major problems with the system. We need more say by the people who are using it. Second, the bills that we get are inscrutable. I had some knee problems last year. I ended up with bills 1.5 inches tall, and it was a relatively minor problem. We're not talking about surgery or anything. So I called the hospital, and I said, can you help me understand these? And they said, sure. And after an hour and a half, the financial director of the hospital said, you know what? I can't understand them either. So that's number two. Number three, and I think you've covered this a bit, the deductibles. So the hospitals aren't getting the money one way, so they have to go to the deductibles. The deductibles are through the roof. They charged me $750 an hour for physical therapy on my knee. That's how they're getting their money. And the fourth thing is the Green Mountain Healthcare Board, I called them to get a little help to help me understand the bills that, you know, say I think I'm being charged way too much. I got zero response. They said we have no way to help on this situation. So those are my comments, and thank you very much.
Okay, Claire, thanks very much. I think a lot of people share Claire's experience with trying to decipher a healthcare bill. It looks like it's in a different language.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree with the first three points that Claire made. For the last point, Claire, I apologize if we did not meet your standard in getting information to you or making people available to you. And if you contact me, I will make sure that we fix that. As far as the three things, deductibles are the thing that really frustrate me, meaning we basically have a system where people are going to need insurance for their insurance. I'm thinking 5 years out, 10 years out. If we're at $6,000 deductibles for individuals, where's that going to be in 10 years? And how can we grow this at a sustainable rate and address the cost shift so that this isn't borne by the actual person receiving care?
Today in the program, our guest is the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobay. When we come back, we're going to take a look at some alternatives to the current fee-for-service system. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Al Gobay, chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. We're discussing ways to control health care costs in Vermont without affecting the quality of care. Let's look at this email that we got from Dave, who feels that the current fee-for-service payment model is ridiculous. He went to Fletcher Allen for a painful lump of scar tissues in his nerve and a foot. His doctor charged his insurance company several hundred dollars for x-rays and several thousand dollars for an MRI. What's wrong with this fee-for-service system? And you've been talking about this for some time. Dave is very concerned about it. What are the faults that you see with the current system?
So, the problem is that when I say that we should move away from fee-for-service, that doesn't mean that we're going to move away from deductibles and bills and claims and all that. What it means is that we want the system, which we're, hopefully going to design and grow and build in our state, to be a system that focuses on prevention and keeping people healthy. So that they don't need emergency rooms and complex care that's costly. That's the idea. Basically, fee-for-service is the concept where every single thing that you do in medicine, you receive a bill for. Moving toward what we call capitation or some payment methodology where doctors are paid for outcomes and for quality and not just doing things is where we'd like to see the system move. And frankly, it's where most of the hospitals and physician thought leaders in the state want to move as well, because they recognize the things that we're talking about. It is a very, very, very bad system when you cannot access a primary care doctor and your only alternative is to go to the emergency room where care is delivered in a way that the doctor doesn't know your history, doesn't know your family, doesn't know you. The way to make this work is through increasing primary care and focusing on your wellness and you as a person. But that doesn't help the person that wrote that email who's upset about what something cost. I think cost in the system is a different conversation.
We got this email from CJ, who writes about the cost of treating very sick patients. And CJ thinks you should start at the healthy side of medicine, provide universal coverage for basic services, and then expand it incrementally to include vision exams, dental hygiene, annual office visits for primary care, maybe add office visits for mental health. The whole idea being, let's reimburse healthcare providers for keeping patients healthy. Why is that such a difficult concept to implement?
So I would say that it's actually been implemented to some extent, and not in a universal way, as CJ suggests, but it's been implemented through the Affordable Care Act in the way the deductibles work and copays. primary care has no deductible in the Affordable Care Act. Preventative services do not. For example, a colonoscopy used to be $5,000. I'm throwing that out. That's not a fact. That's just an anecdote. But say it's $5,000. Now, you know, that's covered as a preventative service under the Affordable Care Act. So that's something that the Affordable Care Act did really well, is it said prevention should be included in your insurance, not in your copays and deductibles. And so there has been a move towards that. Has it gone far enough? We can debate that, but at least there's been some progress.
You know, what some people also look at is maybe one hospital charges $2,000 for an MRI, another hospital might charge $3,000 or $4,000. And some folks might be thinking, how come there just isn't one set of prices? So if you need a colonoscopy, no matter where you go, it's X. If you need knee replacement, it's Y. We aren't going to see this huge variation of rates at different regions of the state.
So, you know, what we're talking about there is, you know, there's going to be price variation in healthcare just based on the location, meaning, you know, it property may cost more in Burlington than it does in Berlin. And so how do you factor that into the cost of healthcare? So that's variation that's real and can be done factually. I think the thing that upsets people is just the random variation where you're like, why is that like that? And, you know, the answer is that it's grown to be like this with different payer mixes at every hospital, each hospital having to negotiate its prices with all of its payers in a vacuum. They can't collaborate on it because that would be collusion. And done over time, we end up with this random variation that doesn't make sense to people. And we hear it anecdotally, you know, from folks. The Green Mountain Care Board has done a lot of work on this to bring fact to it. And we can see the random variation in this. The question is, how do you eliminate it without harming these institutions that are so valuable to our communities? Because, you know, Rutland may charge $2,000 more for something or $2,000 less based on their high Medicare and Medicaid populations than another hospital in the state, but you can't make the case that they don't have to cover their costs. And so it's a very, very complicated question. But to the average person, it just I recognize it just seems ridiculous.
So if we had government paying its fair share for Medicaid, then we would see less of a variation from hospital to hospital for these other procedures?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you think about it. If you had one payer, it'd be very easy to say, you know, what is a knee replacement? You know, that takes away all the variation. But, you know, people think there's only Blue Cross in Vermont and MVP because of the exchange conversations. Well, you know, in Rutland, Aetna, you know, has a big population. We don't think about that. You know, in VCures, we have 70 different insurance companies that are submitting data for claims from Vermont hospitals. You know, so it is a very complicated web that to the average person, again, seems ridiculous. But fixing it is not as easy as perhaps I might like.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Adam in Middlebury. Hi, Adam. What's on your mind today?
Hi, I was hoping the director could talk a little bit about the Medicaid expansion in lieu of the fact that there's fairly conclusive proven data discussing how users of Medicaid chronically overspend and at least in the Oregon Health Exchange experiment are found to be no healthier than folks who are actually paying for their health care.
So what I would say is that when I think about Medicaid, you have to travel the state and you have to go visit some of the locations where folks are on Medicaid, you know, with some of the most vulnerable conditions that we have in our state. And at that point you say, I'm a big fan of Medicaid. Because, you know, there's no way to take a look at those problems and not come away with that. And so, you know, the question is not, you know, do we have a Medicaid program? The question is, how do we run a Medicaid program really, really well? And I think that's what the caller is really, really asking. People that are on Medicaid need health care. The question is, how do we deliver it in a way that's efficient, effective, and gets the best outcomes. If, as I've said, Medicaid is a chronic underpayer and access is tough, or there's any stigma to access for a Medicaid recipient, you know, then we're working in the opposite direction. And so I think we need to have a great, robust Medicaid program, but that's efficient and effective and obviously something that we can afford. So
we got this email from Representative Cynthia Browning of Arlington. The inability of the legislature to properly fund Medicaid reimbursements is so ironic. Private insurance companies are being blamed for the rising premiums, which are then used to justify more public insurance. But the private premiums are driven up by the cost shift from programs that are not funded properly, and the legislature must step up to pay for the benefits that they support. I mean, that's what you're really saying. If the government is going to provide these programs, then, hey, you got to pay for it.
Yeah, I think Representative Browning is right on. And I'll also add that, you know, when we talk about these things, it's so easy to think that someone is evil, you know, that some entity is evil. Oh, the evil insurance company or the evil government or the evil, you know, hospital that's charging some price. And, you know, most of what's going on here is just a very complicated intersection of government, providers, nonprofit hospitals, home health, et cetera, the whole healthcare continuum, all trying to work together to take care of people. You know, and, you know, I think that Cynthia makes a very good point that we tend to set it up as if there's good actors and bad actors. And I, after 4 years of being involved in this, I haven't found the bad actors. I see a lot of really good actors that are trying to help people.
Let's talk to John in Richmond. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question has more to do with how we – the goals of what we're trying to do, and the how do we incent people to go from, gee, my foot hurts, I'm going to go see the doctor, to, boy, I'm 30 pounds overweight, maybe I need to look at changing my diet, I need assistance to do that, to avoid not only problems with my feet, but maybe problems with my heart down the road. You talk about prevention, it seems like there's a huge shift in education from the patient population, and I don't hear about that happening from anybody. The providers, the state, I'm just wondering how we're going to get there when we concentrate on the finances and the mechanics. So we have to get to the people.
Yeah, John, I would 100% agree with your point. And I tend to, you know, a flaw of mine is I tend to focus on finances because I've been a business person for far too long. And that's, you know, sort of where my mind goes. I think if I could channel Dr. Alan Ramsey kind of convey his thoughts on this, not speaking for him, but just after listening to him speak for the last several years. You know, when you're a primary care doc and you have 15-minute office visits, it's awful hard to spend time with somebody talking about their weight or talking about their drinking or talking about their home life. And, you know, as you know, fee-for-service is, you know, for most of these primary care docs, a 15-minute, you know, turn where every 15 minutes there's a new patient and they got to go, 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 go. And, you know, there's a lot of good thinking out there that would suggest allowing primary care docs to take care of the health of a given population with more time to spend with patients would actually accomplish what it is that you've mentioned, John.
I mean, does the importance of prevention get even larger if you look at where Vermont's healthcare dollars go? Something like 80% of the state's healthcare costs are spent on 20% of the people who have chronic illness. So you can nibble you want all you with the people who don't have chronic illnesses. But if you don't address that issue, you're really never going to get to the nub of the problem.
You're right. I mean, there's all of these charts and studies that show in the last 6 months of life in this given population, end stage renal disease, all this stuff. You say, well, you know, that's diabetes, type 2 diabetes. This is where the money goes. Well, but go upstream of that and say, you know, how did they get to the point where they have end-stage renal disease? Or how did you get to the point where you have type 2 diabetes? You know, and I think this is where, you know, John's point is just absolutely dead on. If there are interventions and education in people's lives prior to this acute event happening, you can put off a lot of cost. You know, and I will also say that other countries spend a lot more time and money and effort on what we call the social determinants of health than we do here in the United States or in Vermont. And it's that type of investment that makes the, and I'll use the word herd, but the herd more healthy. You're not going to, you know, solve it in the last 6 months of someone's life if they have, you know, a very serious chronic condition or multiple chronic conditions in most cases.
Let's turn to Betty in Rutland. Hi, Betty. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Good show, as usual. My comment is that I really think we need to do something about people coming into the state and instantly getting on welfare and Medicaid. And they do that. Being here in Rutland, it's paramount. And the people do not take care of themselves. You can't help but see them in the doctor's offices or in the hospital and when I have to go there or whatever. And their only goal is just to go to another doctor and get another medication because it's all taken care of for them.
Is this a problem in your experience?
I don't have any facts on that. I mean it's an anecdotal piece, but I wouldn't have any facts to be able to answer on that.
What I think you did touch on, though, is if you have a growing number of people on Medicaid, and expanded Medicaid is a good example of that, and if there's underfunding of Medicaid, then some primary care doctors are going to say, listen, there's a limit to how many people we can take, and your goal is to make sure that the Medicaid people who can't find primary care help don't end up in the emergency room. But isn't that the likelihood of what's going to happen?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, what I would say is that we as a state, we as a people, and we as the United States now have said that, you know, for people at this level of income on down, we want to offer them health care. And, you know, that's a decision that's been made. And I think we have to figure out how to do that really, really well. And we also have to take a look at, Steve Constantino's doing a great job at Medicaid, but I'm talking now for the next 5 years or 10 years, how do the leaders of our state envision this working so that we're providing access for these folks, high quality care for these folks, but also not expecting the provider community to bear the burden of this in a way that sort of twists and contorts the system that we're trying to build.
We're almost out of time, but what's one thing that you think, if it's done in the next year or two, could have a dramatic impact on this whole subject of healthcare costs?
So what I would say is that if we could, with the federal government, agree to a trend, a growth spend on healthcare services, and actually work with the folks at Medicare, work with the folks at Medicaid, and work with the folks at commercial insurance to come up with a unified way of paying for healthcare that allows providers to focus on basically population health. And this is this all-payer model that we've talked about. If we can do that, then I think that we've grabbed the steering wheel and we would actually be in control of where we're going. Now, I want to be clear. That's not us taking over Medicare or taking over Medicare money and no changes to beneficiaries. But literally, the way that these payers interact with providers needs to be unified because we're driving the docs crazy.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion of healthcare issues facing the state of Vermont. Green Mountain Care Board Chairman Al Gobay, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up next, I'll talk with 7 Days political reporter Terry Hallenbeck about some of the candidates who are thinking about running for governor in 2016. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Governor Peter Shumlin's decision not to seek re-election to a fourth term in office has a lot of people thinking about running for governor in 2016. There are a number of Democrats, Republicans, progressives, and independents taking a serious look at this race. Terry Hallenbeck covers Vermont politics for 7 days, and she joins us now to help us understand who might be in, who might be on the fence, and who might not run when all is said and done. Hi, Terry. Thanks for being on the program.
Hi, Bob. Thanks.
So let's start with the Democrats and start off with former Windsor Senator Matt Dunn. He has some experience running for governor. He was part of that five-candidate field in the 2010 Democratic gubernatorial primary that was won by Peter Shumlin. He seemed to surprise a lot of people when he filed a campaign finance report last month that showed that he had raised more than $100,000 in just 8 days. Now, Dunn says he's still, quote, evaluating if there's enough support for a gubernatorial run. But do you think he will run in the end?
Well, yeah. I mean, he's raised over $100,000. And if he doesn't run, he's not already in office. That's in some other office to spend that money on. I think he wanted to send a message to other candidates that, look, I've got money already. That means I've got certain supporters already. And then he wanted some time to get his ducks in a row campaign-wise, and I would say he's in.
Now, if he does run, and it sounds like he will, does he become sort of an outsider candidate?
Well, he's one of the candidates who wouldn't have whatever just went on with the legislature and the governor slapped on him. You know, you can't readily blame him for the property tax situation or the education bill that just passed or whatever. He's been out of politics for a few years, gaining business background. So, yeah, he's a bit of an outside candidate.
Now, a second possible Democratic candidate would be House Speaker Shap Smith. He's definitely considering a run for governor. You talked to him recently. What are the factors that he's considering?
Well, he said he's made up his mind. He just won't tell us yet. He's going to tell us in 2 weeks. And then I said, well, are you raising money as others are, for instance, Matt Dunn and Phil Scott? And he said, well, I'm talking to people about that. And I said, well, you don't talk to people about that if you're not running. You know, and he said, well, you know, I could run for speaker again, which is true. But I think that he, just as Dunn is, he's getting his ducks in a row and getting ready for a campaign.
What are some of the challenges you think that Shap Smith might face in a Democratic primary?
Sometimes he's difficult to pin down of exactly where on the political spectrum is he. Is he liberal? Is he moderate? He sort of deftly plays both hands. And as you're running for governor, you're going to need to be pinned down on that, especially in a primary. The progressives, the leftist side of the Democratic Party, not necessarily a huge fan of his, but not a huge enemy either. You know, so he will have a challenge to declare who he really is.
Now, a third possible Democrat is Transportation Secretary Sue Minter. Your story in 7 days this week took a close look at a possible Minter candidacy. Who's encouraging her to run?
Well, Madeline Cunin is in her ear big time. You know, not telling her she has to run, but encouraging her, trying to help her sort through the questions that one has when one starts to contemplate this. And pretty much telling her you don't have to settle for lieutenant governor. You know, those who don't want her to run, you know, would say, oh, she hasn't run a statewide campaign before. She's never been in charge of anything electorally. She's in charge of the Agency of Transportation. So she's got Madeline Cunin and others telling her, you would be a great candidate. And it's been 30 years since a woman took office as governor, and there's only ever been one, and that's not right, is their message.
As you mentioned, some Democrats do want her to run for lieutenant governor because they think there will be an open seat there. But it sounds like you feel that's kind of unlikely at this point.
Well, between Madeline's message, you don't have to settle for it, and Sue Minter seemed to be buying that message of, well, I've been running the Agency of Transportation, second largest agency in state government, huge amounts of federal money, and negotiating with the federal government over funding, which has always been a problem. And then to think, well, I'll go to this one-person office, you know, two-person office, you know, where you basically don't really oversee an entity. It's something for her to think about.
Let's switch over and look at the Republicans. All eyes are on incumbent Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. He says he's taking a very serious look at running for governor, but he has to sort out how it would affect his construction business. So what are the issues there?
Well, you have to put a firewall between you and your business because his business gets state contracts. It's an excavation business. And just figuring out how to do that logistically, how to not sell the business because he wants, you know, to still own it when he was done with politics.
Do you think running for re-election for lieutenant governor is an option for Phil Scott?
Well, I don't know. Like he told me back in June around the time that Peter Shumlin announced he wasn't running again, Phil Scott said that that was a possibility that he might not run for anything. Then last week or so, he told my colleague Paul Heinz that, oh, I'll probably be running for something. I think he's running for governor. I mean, I do think that he and Shap Smith and Matt Dunn are all in the same category of trying to hone their message to say, here's what I got to do to my business, my personal life. Here's who I might want working for me. You know, we don't want to give them that time, but that's they want some time to figure out what would a campaign really be.
Now, Terry, there are some Republicans who really don't like Phil Scott. They don't think he's been critical enough of the Shumlin administration. They can't believe that he agreed to be part of Shumlin's cabinet. They would like to see Libertarian Dan Feliciano run in the Republican gubernatorial primary. What are the chances of this happening?
Well, I think he could. I think he's no longer a Libertarian. You know, I think he considers himself a Republican now. So I think it's likely that he might run again. I do think that a lot of people are hoping Phil Scott runs. So I think that's a sort of minority part of the party that they've definitely not really loved Phil Scott, that segment of the party. He's not conservative enough. He doesn't challenge the governor enough. But electorally, he's probably their best bet.
Terry, there are also reports that the founder of Campaign for Vermont, Bruce Lissman, is looking at a possible gubernatorial run. If Phil Scott decides to run, do you think Lissman would challenge Scott in a GOP primary?
I don't know. I don't know how to read him at all. He keeps doing this where he says, I'm really seriously considering, and then the next election, it's this time I'm really, really considering it. I don't have a good bead on what does he really mean to do.
Is there a possibility he might run as an independent?
I think that's a possibility. I think the Republicans very much want him not to do that. That would split the vote, so to speak. So if he runs, they would rather he just run in the primary. And I think Republicans have granted that a primary is not necessarily a bad thing. The Democrats proved that in 2010 with a five-way primary that left Shumlin stronger, gave him much more name recognition for the general election.
Finally, let's look at the Progressive Party. After supporting Peter Shumlin in the last three elections, they made it very clear they would not back him in 2016 after he decided not to pursue a single-payer health care plan. Do you think they're going to run a candidate for governor, or will they concentrate on the race for lieutenant governor and also try to increase their representation in the Vermont House and Senate?
I think they have, as always, perhaps a real dilemma. Like they do not have a definite viable candidate for governor. They just have people who have other things going on in their lives and can't just do that right now. So I don't know if Sue Minter runs, would she be someone they could support? Maybe. They definitely feel burned by the Democratic Party and Peter Shumlin from 2010 that he did not continue with single-payer health care and other issues they care about. So I think they will be cautious and strategic with their support. Whether that means they have a candidate or whether it means they have a viable candidate, don't know.
They're also looking very seriously at the race for lieutenant governor, aren't they? Aren't they hoping to have kind of a progressive slash Democratic candidate?
There could be some possibility there. David Zuckerman is the state senator from Chittenden County, who's a progressive but gets elected as a P/D, is floating the idea that he might run. So, I mean, yeah, if Phil Scott does not run for lieutenant governor, there will be a lot of interest in that job.
Well, the pieces of campaign 2016 will begin to fall into place in the next month or so, and we'll be following these developments very closely. Terry Hallenbeck of 7 Days, many thanks for being on the program today.
Sure. Thanks, Bob.
That's Vermont Edition for today. Monday on the show, the layoffs at Keurig Green Mountain. The Waterbury Coffee Company has had a roller coaster ride in the last few months. We'll look at its standing in the national beverage industry and its role in Vermont's economy. If you live in Waterbury or work for Keurig Green Mountain, tell us your observations. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us Monday for that discussion. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sengary, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.